Good afternoon to all. Welcome to this fourth and final plenary dialogue of the International Conference on Salutogenesis, which is entitled Way Forward Salutogenesis Beyond the Health Discipline. So if we think and talk about salutogenesis today and yesterday as a primarily health concept, today we're gonna talk about the same concept, but we will move forward with this concept, and we will try to spread this concept to other sectors than health. So my name is Mathieu Roy. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Sherbrooke in the province of Quebec in Canada. And I'm also a scientific advisor at the Quebec National Institute of Health. I'm a member of the core group of the Global Working Group on Salutogenesis since 2016. It's a big pleasure for me to moderate this session today. And with me to help me to moderate, I will have Luis Saboga Nunes, which is gonna help me with the technical issues, because I'm not a technical guy at all. So thank you very much to co-moderate this session with me, Luis. I'm very happy to have your help.
You're welcome.
So this plenary dialogue today will have four main parts. First of all, I will present you all the panelists we have with us today. We have five panelists with us today. Second, I will ask two main questions to each of them, and they will have some time to answer to this these questions. In the third part of the plenary session, we're gonna have a conversation with the audience, and I hope it will be the core moment of this plenary session, because my panelists are very excited and enthusiastic to answer to the questions of people. And we will finally conclude the session with some highlight and a little conclusion. So I would like to introduce each of my panelists, because we have very, very interesting panelists with us today. First of all, we have Claudia Meyer Magistretti, which is a professor of health promotion at Lucerne University of Switzerland. She is also IUHP vice president for partnership, IUHPE vice president of the Global Working Group on Planetary Health, and member of the Global Working Group on Salutogenesis. Her research covers salutogenesis in maternity and early childhood care, education, mental health, salutogenic practices, and also she's working a lot on the sense of coherence concept. She recently wrote a book entitled Knowing and Understanding Salutogenesis in 2019. So welcome, Claudia. We also have the great pleasure to receive Melissa Generer today. Melissa Generer is a physician specialist in public health, but also a researcher. After having been appointed as the Director of Public Health here in Eastern Township, Quebec, Canada, she now acts as a medical advisor at both national levels and regional levels in the province of Quebec, Canada. She has an expertise in the field of disaster management, psychosocial recovery through her strong involvement in many disasters in Canada, for example, in a train derailment tragedy and floods and major fires, and more recently in the context of the pandemic, of course. She developed a strong international network and has contributed to several knowledge transfer activities in the field of psychosocial risk management. So good afternoon, Melissa. We also have with us Patricia Garista, which is an adjunct professor of social pedagogy and lifelong learning at the University of Perugia, Italy. She is also a researcher in pedagogy at the National Institute of Documentation, Innovation and Educational Research. Patricia has been collaborating on many health promotion research, on many health promotion activities, and she was one of the founding editors of Pedagogy in Health Promotion Journal. We also have the huge honor to have with us this afternoon, Shifra Saghi. Shifra is an emeritus professor at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. She currently serves as the head of the Martin Springer Center of Conflict Studies. Her research interests include salutogenesis and coping and adjustment to stressors. She conducts research in political psychology in the context of historical and political consciousness of Israelis and Palestinians. And she has extensively published over the last three decades about that. And she is also the former PhD student of Aaron Antonovsky himself. So it was really, really an honor to have with you this afternoon. And finally, and not the least, Gregor Yeni, which worked at the University of Zurich. Since 2002, he is working in occupational health psychology. He conducts interventions and evaluation research with consultants and companies. The main thing about his work is about salutogenic organizations. In 2009, he received his PhD from the Department of Management, Technology and Economics. His recent work focused on digitalizing salutogenic interventions for individuals and their teams and developing new web applications. So just before that, each panelist will share their highlight of the day. Shifra wants to specify that Antonovsky thought about the possibility to use salutogenesis beyond the health discipline. And I think she wants to take 2 minutes to share Antonovsky's original thought about this. And I will pass the stage to Shifra for the two next minutes.
Thank you very much, Matthew. I hope it will be 2 minutes. If not, you can stop me anytime you want. So as you told Matthew to the audience already, Antonovsky was my teacher, and I had many hours of talking with and discussing and arguing with him about everything and about every subject. But this was very inspiring. When I suggested to the editors of the handbook of salutogenesis to add another section about salutogenesis beyond health, it reminded me very strongly what Aaron himself told me about this issue. And he had very solid opinions about this. And he was somehow very cautious about it, to say it at the least. The paradigm of salutogenesis was introduced within the discipline of medical sociology, not in social psychology, not even in health promotion, not in conflict studies. It was medical sociology that was changed because of Aaron. It was changed to be called the sociology of health. So what interested him was about the relationship between sense of coherence, his core concept, and health. When he offered the salutogenesis, he spoke only about health or disease, the other concept, the contrary concept. I'm very glad to realize that there is a new start here in the conference to broaden it and to wider the framework into interdisciplinary, but and I personally believe that at this stage it's really necessary. But I think we need to know and we need to take into consideration what Aaron thought about it. I brought you, I want to read to you at least one citation. He clarified in his work that a salutogenic orientation, no less than a pathologic one, defines health and disease only in terms of functioning and survival. All that it argues is that the stronger the sense of coherence, the more likely the system, whether it the individual, family, or society, to function and survive. Health and survival. What he meant was that sense of coherence, whose development is influenced naturally by social factors, cannot predict social concepts, which could have a positive or a negative connotation. And why he was so decisive about it. Antonovsky viewed such social factors as loaded by moral philosophical problems, and as such, not inherently within the context of the salutogenesis.
Thank you, Shifra. It's always a pleasure to. Did
you
want to add something?
I have other citation, but maybe in my.
Maybe you can say another one. Of course.
Okay, because he was very. I will cite another. He had a lecture in Prague in 1991. It was a conference of psychologists that invited him. And he warned there of the danger of defining health so that it becomes a catch-all for anything that you think is good. That's what he always told me. To be with strong sense of coherence, it doesn't mean that you are also a good person, that you have good values, that you have other things that you consider that are important. Health, when you do this, health then becomes not a scientific concept, but confused with a set of answers to moral philosophical problems, and the distinction must be made. So when we broaden salutogenesis to include concepts other than health, and I will talk about it later, we cannot avoid these moral philosophical questions about values and about science. Thus, we deal with them while we fully recognizing our limitations in making such a distinction. So if Aaron was instead of me here, he said, don't do it, but I think differently, but I think we need to know about these values that he wanted us to consider seriously. Thank you.
It's so rich to have your input about Aaron, because when you talk about Aaron, we have the impression to be able to talk with him. And that's why I think you are so inspiring for the next generation of researchers such as I and my colleagues. So maybe we can move forward, and just before asking you the question, the core question of this plenary dialogue today, maybe I can left you 2 minutes by panelists to present what was the highlights of the day according to you.
So how do you want to proceed, Claudia? I can start.
You can start.
Okay. So in the last oral session that I attend, I think one thing that emerged clearly is the whole complexity of the pandemic and the post-pandemic management. Huge challenges were reported regarding the long-term psychosocial recovery. And I think we should also keep in mind the economic recovery that will for sure call for much stronger collaboration between health and non-health sectors. That's way too complicated so that only the health sector by itself can achieve this ambitious goal. And we've been talking about the challenges posed by the post-pandemic era, both in the general population, but also in high-risk groups, including the COVID-19 victims, or maybe those who have received a diagnosis of COVID, the communities that were previously impacted by a mass trauma, the racialized communities, drug users or opioid users. So all of these people may show some specific needs and also, of course, some specific strengths that need to be taken into account. So I also realized that we had a pretty wide range of disciplines from the experts and also a wide range of countries that seems really interested into using the salutogenic framework as a powerful tool to better inform the approach to these very complex situations and conditions. So to me, what I remind from all these very rich discussions this morning and today is that more than ever, we need to work all together and we need to share all of this valuable knowledge that was acquired over the past months and why not years.
Thank you, Melissa. Gregor? What was your highlight?
Yeah, voluntarily. We discussed in our workshop how we can integrate salutogenic thinking better into organizations, mainly also into business companies, which are these complex social systems with their own logic and routines. And it was a very lively discussion. I'll just pick out two things which I thought were very interesting. One was the discussion, how can we get this kind of thinking into the strategy level, into the management level, and what concepts might work with those kind of people? Because salutogenesis or coherence aren't just the kind of markers or words that work there. Maybe it's better using concepts like optimal functioning or a holistic balance of work, people, and the environment, something like that. And one participant had a great idea because she already tried that to describe to our target group what we actually mean with salutogenesis, sort of a rich description of what it is, and let them find their own word that fits to their system and to their logic. So that's a really cool idea, which I certainly will try out. And the other thing was that we discussed how can we trigger a participatory process of optimizing work, because participation is so central to our kind of thinking. But many companies often are not so used to it. So to these kind of participatory processes, where leaders engage in a self-organized team development process where they essentially take over ownership and agency for the topic, and what kind of mind maps and words do they need for such a kind of process to so essentially build up a space and culture for salutogenesis from the bottom up. So that will be two very, very nice discussions we had this afternoon.
Thank you, Gregor. Claudia, would you like to add something?
Yes, I would like to share our highlight today, which was the opportunity to hold our first workshop in an international conference on the People, Planet, Health project. This project relates salutogenesis to planetary health, explaining how all the policymakers and of the international world climate summits still think in this risk avoiding model. We have a catastrophe coming, we have to prevent this catastrophe, and you have to fly less, to eat more, less meat, and all these predictions that they they pronounce, but so far they fail to change anything. And then we explained the salutogenic view of planetary health, which is that the change for a better planet, for a healthier planet and healthier people is already happening, because there are all over the world young people, grassroots initiatives, local organizations who link various topics from nutrition to contraception, from transport to hospital care quality to planetary health. And all these linkages are happening, but they're not visible. And this is what People Planet Health, the project, wants to do. We do not only want to make it visible, but we want to link the grassroots movements with the global policy. That's why we call the program GLOCAL. And it's so we had from the beginning Dr. Krech, the director of health promotion of WHO, supporting this project personally. He opened the webinar when we advertised for groups to join us. And we will now, together with also, again, people from WHO, Abdel Ben Aziz is among them, write with the grassroots groups in a participatory process a position paper. We hope it's going to be a joint position paper for the next strategy for health promotion in WHO that's going to be presented in November. This is what we did. What was the highlight about this was the workshop we had. We had young people from Africa, from Australia, who stayed up to participate, and very lively discussions on how to shape this participatory process, how to initiate it, and also new knowledge about new associations we have in the salutogenic community, such as the Brazilian Society for Psychological and Planetary Health and other people. What is also, what was also a topic is that after the position paper, the salutogenic community will have the task, not only the salutogenic, but we also, the task to scale these grassroots movements up to make these movements bigger or more visible. This is not something we can do only by one project. So I'm afraid I took more than 2 minutes.
Patricia, what was your highlight?
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. Well, during the session on salutogenesis, school and other educational settings, I listened to a presentation that gave multiple and polysemic understandings of the possible application of the salutogenic model. I was inspired by all of them, and I think that they all represent possible trajectories for future research in this field in relation to 3 points that can be summarized as the focus. They addressed both health and educational issues as experiences able to generate quality of life. Then methodologies, they describe projects applying quantitative and qualitative methodologies. And then there is an interesting focus on the use of language. No, there was a presentation during which we discussed that sometimes changing words and using a salutogenic vocabulary can change the perspective. So it was very interesting. And then the context. They consider different educational settings, even if they were strictly related to institutional formal educational settings, such as schools and universities. And so I was inspired by the complexity and flexibility featured by this representation, which were able to consider resources and opportunities for both health development and academic learning. And I was inspired also by the idea of looking for latent aspects of health. So a question could be how to make health visible, no? How can we look for health in these settings? No, it was very interesting. And another point, very interesting in another presentation, it was a model for using a salutogenic framework within an institutional network, Ministry of Education, and to create a network of a working group where politicians, academics, and educators work together to find solutions to school issues. And that it's very important in this phase defining salutogenic questions in this educational field, because it could help other countries to go in the same direction.
Thank you. Shifa?
Yes, thank you. I was very impressed in this conference about the broadening of salutogenesis to so many subjects, so many methods, and so many research disciplines. It was very exciting for me because I know how we started. It was very strict, as I told you, to health, to measure health and to measure disease, and even only physical health, and even not mental health. After it, we started also mental health. We were very strict in the beginning. So I was very excited from this, but from all the what I noticed in this conference, I'm very excited about the research of the pandemic, like you said, Melissa. And I will tell you why I am excited about, not because we are also part of such international, Claudia and Matthew and also Melissa and others, of such international research. But what excited me is I always feel alone in my country, in my laboratory of stress. And as you know, I live in Israel, I was born there, and my laboratory is in my life. I don't need laboratory at the university. Life is my laboratory with all the stressor. But when the pandemic started, I remember I wrote to the Global Work Group of Salutogenesis, now we are all in the same boat. Let's do it together. And you remember, Claudia, you said. So suddenly I felt that, first of all, the pandemic fits very much Antonovsky's fundamental philosophical assumptions about the world. The world is full of chaos, the world is full of stressors, and nothing is harmonious, and we need only to find ways how to cope with it. So it fits very well his philosophical assumptions about the world. And now what I surprised very much and is that I read many research in the journal, in the medical journal, with pathogenic questions about the pandemic. Most of the research is pathogenic oriented. And here I came and saw, wow, there are so many who came to this pandemia, awful pandemia, and tragic pandemia with salutogenic question, and they found different answers than the pathogenic ones. And what we also found, and after is that the old, for me, it's old sense of coherence predicts wellness, predicts mental health all over the world in different contexts, in so many cultures. The sense of coherence works well. About other I see in your face that I need to stop. So about the other factors that I'm interested, I will talk maybe later. Thank you.
Don't be scared, Shifra. We will talk about this again. But maybe maybe it's the time for the first main questions, main question of the plenary dialogue today. And I will ask this question to all of you, my panelists. So on the basis of your expertise and on the basis of the preceding sessions that you attend to, whatever it was, oral, workshop, posters, how do you think salutogenesis can move from the health discipline and be spread to other social fields? How do you think it is possible to do it? And maybe we can use the same order. So I will let the stage to Melissa.
Okay, good. There's so many things that could be said about this, but to me, it's not even a question. Salutogenesis need to go much further than the within health organizations. And why? Because we know that during and after a crisis like the pandemic, first of all, health organizations tend to focus much more on dealing with the emergency, like the virus, fires, explosions, floods, storms, and so on. But inevitably, in the months and years that are coming, these same actors, they absolutely need to get prepared to deal with adverse psychosocial impacts of such disasters. And we need not only to document the situation, but also to find a way to better address the individual and community resilience. This is really key. And the psychosocial recovery from traumatic events like the pandemic is really everyone's business. This is impossible to achieve only within the health sector. And we also need to think out of the box. We need to break silos. We need to increase much more our collaborations between health and non-health sectors to develop and implement a null of society approach based on community assets and capacities. So in other words, we need a much less clinic-centered approach and a much more community approach. And we have very rich learning from huge disasters that we had here in Quebec, Canada, that is the Lac-Mégantic train derailment in July 2013. I was talking about this in my oral session. And we have used a salutogenesis framework to promote resilience in the years following these disasters. And we have learned so much. And I'm really proud to say that today, the Minister of Quebec, of Health and Social Sciences in Quebec, social services, they just decided in November 2020 that they would learn from this very rich experience and they would also implement a salutogenic approach. So they decided to invest a $19 million investment to put in place through the whole Quebec, a network of mental health scouts, which I'm about to discuss maybe in the context of the next question. So there's really something going on and it needs to be worked all together.
Thank you, Melissa. We expect already the second question. I think Gregory were the second. So now it's your time.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. For me and what I do in my work, it's on the one hand always about good storytelling. I mean, humans are storytelling animals, so get a good story out there. And on the other hand, it's about the use of technology. For me, that is digital applications. Since 10 years, there are so many successful e-health apps on the market for treating mental health disorders, such as anxiety or depression, but also to promote mindfulness, which I also use for myself, and which also companies are using more and more for coping with stress. So I see a way to make salutogenesis more visible as part of sort of the self-monitoring and self-regulation that people do with their digital devices. I mean, they do it. So why not take that opportunity and to get people talking about salutogenesis? I mean, give them the words, give them the language, because in the end, they have to talk about it themselves. Not we have to talk to them about it. They have to talk about salutogenesis themselves and move them into action through little surveys, exercises, and most importantly, I think into actions that can be done together with others, so that not only the story spreads, but also that the humans come together in mutual agency, as I would say. That would be my idea.
That's a great idea. I like that. What is your answer to my question, Claudia?
Well, yeah, my answer is that we have to be very clear. As Schiffer said, we have to be clear what we talk about when we talk of cellulogenesis. When we talk about the methodology, the SOC, then, as Antonovsky and Schiffer and many others say, it measures health, nothing more. It's a measure for health. But cellulogenic theory, we need not expand. It had always been more than just health. Because Antonovsky wrote himself that it's a theory of life, a life concept, not a health concept theory. And Bengt Lindstrom linked it then further to the quality of life discussion and Schiffer to conflict discussions and so on. And we do not have, we do not promote health because we do not want to have a good quality of life because you want to achieve health. It's the other way around. Health is a mean for a good life. So the theory has always been wider. And think of the general resistance resources. They cannot be tackled within health sector. They are wider. And Antonovsky himself defined them wider. But there's a big, big but. As more as salutogenic theory is expanding, I think as more we have to discuss as we do it this now, because I didn't know, Schiffer, that Antonovsky wrote this, but it's something I often think. We cannot say anything that's salutogenic is good and anything that's good is salutogenic. And this is a danger when it spreads. So we have to be clear in methodology, clear in our concepts of the general resistance resources, of the continuum of health, not defining it, not talking about what is good health, but defining the process of health. And we have to be clear about the measurement of SOC and what it measures. And so I would not say that we should go into a direction where anything goes, but we should reflect on our basic concept. And also because salutogenesis is linked to health promotion, and here again, I'm together with Morris and Bengt and Schiffer and others, here we have to always bring in the discussion of human rights, of social justice, and we have to define values on how we see health promotion, but we have to separate values and salutogenic theory and methodology. This is what I would like to answer.
And I would also add to salutogenic theory, salutogenic concept, salutogenic orientation. So three levels of salutogenic concept and things. So now it's the time for Patricia.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. Well, considering the previous presentation in my session, but also considering some reflection coming from yesterday. For instance, yesterday there was also the workshop organized by the European Training Consortium, which follows no, a salutogenic vision of learning. I think that a lot of stimulating inputs have been given. I think that the pandemic turned amplified the need for shifting the salutogenic paradigm into the educational world. But at the same time, I believe that this world needs to be prepared, to be mentored. For instance, observing schools and teachers in Europe, I think that we need a salutogenic vocabulary, which is comprehensible and meaningful for those who work in the field of education. And nowadays, for instance, schools are completely absorbed by the framework of Agenda 2030. No, their priorities, planning activities related to its goals. And this is a risk of fragmentation instead of integration. And I think that methodologically, the qualitative research on biographies, on narratives and case studies could help teachers and health educators to be this salutogenic vocabulary for posing salutogenic questions that could be comprehensible, meaningful, and manageable for those who have a health promotion background, but also for those who have an educational background. And this could help to create a coherence between these two sectors. And then I think also that health educators probably should enlarge their view of school and university, maybe working more with informal educational settings and targeting vulnerable groups, no? In what we can call, we say, the in-between, no? Where connections and relationship happen. And so the idea is to imagine salutogenesis as a lifelong learning process, but also life wide, life deep. And this is my idea for shifting. So there are very inspiring perspectives, but at the same time, some problem, no, to connect these two sectors.
Oh, I also agree with you. Salutogenesis within the educational sector, it's a huge area that that we have to invest. What do you think, Shifra?
I would like to differentiate between salutogenesis as a paradigm, as a theory. For me, it's a way to ask questions, to ask salutogenic question instead of pathogenic question as psychologist. And between the salutogenesis as a theory and the concept of sense of coherence, they are not identical. And people sometimes combine these two as identical concept. No, the salutogenic question can be different. The main salutogenic question is about health. Saluto, it's health. Salutogenesis, what causes, what promotes health. But I think we can ask other salutogenic question, like who can be health promote, a peace promoter, not only health promoter, who can be peace activist, or who can be the politician who will work for human rights. We need to look for this. But these are different salutogenic questions about that I think we need to ask in the future. And there are many new researchers now in the salutogenesis, and I think they can, I hope they will take this, my English. Anyway, this challenge and go with this. The other thing is the sense of coherence. Sense of coherence is only one answer to the salutogenic question of who will be the healthy people, the healthy men or the healthy women, even if they are going through pandemic or through war or through and life itself is a, so who will be healthy? Who will be healthy physical? Who will be healthy, mentally healthy? But this is only one answer to the salutogenic questions. And I think we need to look for other answers, not only sense of coherence. It's not identical to salutogenesis. That's what I try to convey. Thank you.
You explained it very well, and maybe we can try to address this this challenge right now with the second question. And my second question will be about the pandemic. In the aftermath of the pandemic, in fact, and after many restricting social measures that caused social exclusion for many, can salutogenesis increase social justice globally and well-being in our communities? So this is a question that we have to address. And thank you for this opportunity, Shifra. What do you think, Marisa?
Yes, So I'll get back to this new innovation, which is called in Quebec, the new network of psychological health scouts that is currently under deployment, because that's exactly the main purpose of this project. So what we want to do is forces us not only to look at the problems and risk factors, but also see at the community level, what are the strengths, what are our assets or resources, and how can we make the most of them? So we really need to recognize that many people in communities are already mobilized, or they have the desire to rally together. And sometimes just simply better connecting them with each other can be enough to heal from a traumatic event like the pandemic. So we shouldn't forget about this. So the Scouts Network team at the community level are going to be there to facilitate all this reconnecting between people, and are going to be there to encourage the setting up of community mobilization projects and citizen engagement. So it can be through door to door and reaching out to people, including, of course, hard to reach ones. It's just about, hey, we're here. And you know what? We don't want to do the work for you. We just want to accompany you. We want to make you realize how rich the community is and how full of resources it is. And in Lac Mégantic, the huge disaster that we experienced a couple of years ago in Quebec, that's exactly what we did, and the magic happened by itself. We helped some people who were living in isolation, who were suffering from big loneliness, who had lost their jobs, who were drinking too much, who are not healthy. And simply by inviting them to reconnect with their community and to make new sense of this new reality in the post-disaster context, it's changed everything, and it literally saved lives. So I'm really happy to see that now we're going to have the additional resources, but this time across the whole Quebec province, so that we're going to try to repeat this very rich experience at a much larger scale. And I hope that other countries are about to do the same thing.
Thank you, Melissa. Just before letting the stage to Gregor, my co-moderator, Luis, say that you can begin to send your question for the question period that will follow this second question. So don't be scared to use the chat box on the website conference. So Gregor?
Oh yeah, man, Matt, when you posed the question, I thought, I've got no clue. Eh? But then I thought, well, I'll just answer this from my personal little life experience during the pandemic. And I can say that it really had a hit on my feeling of communion and my feeling, especially on my feeling of agency. So it's a little bit of self-efficacy crisis here, which are both really key elements sort of for experience meaning. And what we did, probably like most of you, we sort of tried to activate our social resources in our work community, sort of to keep things manageable, to experience some communion together and also some agency. And all this really sort of also sharpened the awareness for each other's needs and feelings, and what sort of triggered this so that we ask more about how is it going, what do you need at the moment, how do you feel at the moment. So I feel that a sudden new sense for what other people need, and which sort of also strengthens our community, our communion, and also empathy with the others, maybe have a little impact somehow on our probably not on social justice, but maybe sort of in a small kind of way that we sort of think, okay, what do the others need? What do they feel in these situations? I hope for a bit more empathy through this pandemic. When I look outside, I sometimes think, okay, it's over. Everybody is behaving like beforehand. So I'm not sure if the pandemic really will have a lasting impact on our community and our social justice.
Thank you, Gregor. And you talk about empathy, and I know that you are very active on application, and I agree with you, just on the social media, that's actually a miss. So thank you very much for your interventions. Claudia?
Yes, I think I don't know if it will last, but what happened during the pandemic and what is still happening in the countries where the pandemic is still high, the incidence is still high, is that the people themselves create communities and create better access for all to health resources, not only by organizing the shopping. We had in the IUHPE conference the example of India. When the school closed down, the adolescents who didn't go to school organized transport chains for oxygen to hospitals or to families that needed them. So they created communities, they created coherence also among themselves, but also over other systems of the social groups. And we also had a wonderful example this morning from, I have to see the name, John Dirks, I think from the Netherlands, who showed us how they facilitated the process of creating coherent communities in disadvantaged neighborhoods. So we can learn a lot about this pandemic because we learn how people do create what you said, coherence and justice, or at least more equal access to health resources. But we have to see how to make this visible again, and to have to see what do we have to do to facilitate these processes or to support them, not only in the moment of emergency, but over. Maybe, and it's, we should also tell the different story, the salutogenic story of the pandemic, as Shifra said, because people create coherence and health together. And I think it's because this is maybe a deeply human need to do so. And then salutogenesis could only strengthen this need and not help to suppress the wishes that communities might have by themselves. This is my idea.
Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you, Matthew. Yes, I think that the pandemic has influenced knowledge building, proposing practices that call for adaptive actions to respond to this health emergency. No? And this seems that this kind of pedagogy and this kind of way of organizing teaching and learning is not empowering people. No? So in this time of crisis, it seems that this pandemic pedagogy is defining not only practices, you know, how to manage distance learning, for instance, but is defining systems of knowledge, identities, and relationship. And we see that how relationships have changed in school, but also in the university. And so this is a risk. This is a risk because it contributes to a pathogenic vision of learning. But at the same time, it could be an opportunity to rethink education and to face and reorganize a new vision of education at school, at the university, but also in other settings. I mean, I don't know, prison, for instance, or other settings. And the focus could be on the agency, for instance, of the subjects, or on the affirmation of human rights, or the fight against inequalities, or the focus on inclusion. And I think, as before I said, that maybe we have to enlarge settings, no, to think about also more to informal setting. I think that we can also enlarge the use of narratives, for instance. No, usually in narrative research we use biographical methods, stories, but they are often centered on personal, on individual experiences, no? And it could be very useful for me think also about memories and the cultural heritage as a sort of a repository of example of how people and societies survived and thrived to emergency along our history. And for this reason, I think that it could be very useful, no, to mobilize, to know how in the history societies and people have recognized resources, mobilized these resources. And also trying to explore how our cultural products, no, and how they were produced and how they can teach us something about even about nature, no, is in about this part. And this is also an example for exploring how people manage their personal well-being with the common good. And I think that this is the central concept, you know, when we talk about salutogenesis and social justice. I think that we have to balance these two aspects. And so I think that in this way, salutogenesis can increase social justice, connecting health, human rights, and empowering people.
Thanks. I will let the stage to Shifra, and after that, we're going to have an exchange with the audience.
Okay. So I need to disappoint you in this point about salutogenesis and human rights. But I hope you remember the remarks of Aaron Antonovsky about this. But I will start with my personal story. When I wrote to the global work of salutogenesis, hey, we are all in the same boat in this awful pandemic. We don't know what to do. We don't know how it acts. It was in the beginning. And I wrote, now we are all in the same boat. After it, I thought to myself, are we in the same boat? No, we were not in the same boat. In several aspects, yes, but in others, no, because we lived at this time and also now in a political conflict, very hard political conflict inside Israel. And of course, we are living in a conflict area between us and the Palestinians, and we are living in a conflict. So the pandemic was another element in the conflict. And how we deal with it. And for the last 10 years, I think I'm doing research about, together with my wonderful group research, about a concept which is called sense of national coherence. It's the same sense of coherence, but regarding our national, and are we perceiving our nation as meaningful to us? Are we perceiving it as managing? How can it manage the crisis, especially the pandemic, but the crisis that we are living all the time? And the last is it comprehensible for us, for me as a person, when I look at my nation? What we found, that the strong sense of national coherence is a very good resource together with the personal sense of coherence, but it's as a national, as a resource to deal, to cope with crisis, also the pandemic. But what we found, that among the, it's not the left, it's center-left wing voters. We ask about the vote, we also ask, what did you vote in the last elections? We have elections every 2 months, but those who voted against the government had a lower sense of national coherence. They have the same sense of coherence, the personal, but the national sense of coherence, this resource was lower among them. And they were more anxious and they were less mental health. We found the same in the United States. There was Trump. You remember there was Trump? Then
among, I don't know him.
You don't know him. But in the beginning of the pandemic, I didn't know what is COVID-19. And those who voted against him, well, also we found the same pattern. They had less sense of national coherence. They were more anxious. They were less mental health. And the same in Brazil. So the countries who had inside the conflict and political conflict, the sense of national coherence for those who were in opposition was not a resource and was not, and they, if we connect it to human rights, they saw more the human rights violations of the government. So how can we develop a sense of national coherence that is open to human rights and is open to the human rights of the other and is open to reconciliation? How to develop this? This is what I'm working now together with my team. This is my question. But as it is now, what I've found that there is, the connection is negative. And I was very sorry to see it. I told you I will disappoint you, Matthew.
You never disappoint me. So we talk about a lot of things, but now I would like to hear the question that the audience have for our panelists. Luis, can you share some question that you received?
Yes, Matthew, thus far, we don't have specific questions in the chat box. So I believe that we need to warm up our participants with some hints. And I think that Shifra brought up a very interesting point that could be the starting point for a very good conversation. And I'm sure that the participants would engage also in it. I know that Shifra's brought a very particular position because she is in the center of a tornado, of the many tornadoes we have in the world, and her vision is somehow very realistic. So I wonder, I'm just putting a question just to break the ice. Okay, I hope that others may follow.
Please do it.
Shifra, would you say that is this... the conclusion that you share with us, is it a worldwide perspective, or is it prone to very specific conditions like those that we find in Israel today, that, as we know, are sometimes historically driven by very strong feelings, and that people sometimes they override some rationality to go after those historical feelings. Would you say that this could be the reason why you feel not so much positive about it?
I think we need to do research, maybe in your country, Luis, in Portugal, in other areas, because the areas that I and the intergroup relations that we examined were mostly among Israelis and Palestinians, inside Israel between ultra-religious, ultra-Orthodox religious and not religious, between among these Arab Israelis, between Muslims and Christians, for example, and between Palestinians from both sides of the border, we say. And also we found the same pattern. The strongest your sense of community coherence or national coherence, the more you are adopting a separation attitude to the other group, the more you are against and don't accept the narrative of the other. You have no empathy. You talked about empathy, Gregor. You have more anger about them, even if they are in the same both groups of Jews or both groups of Arabs, but with the different religions. I also had a doctoral student, Mimoza Telaku, who is from Kosovo. And Kosovo is post-conflict. It's considered post-conflict. And when I came to Kosovo, I asked her to bring together Albanians and Serbians that we can do some dialogue. She said, we can't do it. We can't do it. We do it in Israel all the time, between Israel and Arab. But in Kosovo, the post-conflict, they can't do it. But she also did the same. She adopted the same questionnaire to Albanian and Serbians in Kosovo. And she found the same pattern. The more you are coherent in your in-group, the more you are, you don't accept the other, and you are, it's not accepting the other is the least, it's very delicate saying. The more you are racist even, and the more you are separating yourself, and the more you don't accept the narrative at all, and the less you are open to some reconciliation.
Yes.
So we are in a very, we are in a cycle, you know, because we need our sense of national coherence of community in order to be resilient to what is going on in the conflict, to be healthy, to mental health. And at the same time, it's in the cycle of not be opening to the other.
That's very interesting, because what you are actually saying, it's a sense of national coherence is a coin with both sides. One side which could be empowering and another side that could be a weapon.
So we have Melissa, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to bounce back on what was said just previously, because we just published a paper on repeated cross-sectional surveys that were conducted in several countries, including United States, England, Belgium, Switzerland, Canada, Hong Kong, Philippines, and New Zealand. And anyway, from June 2020 to November 2020, we saw a deterioration in mental health in each of the single countries under investigation, but United States. So I find really interesting all this discussion about the sense of national coherence, because as you remember, the presidential elections in the United States were at the very beginning of November 2020, and our data collection was just like a few days or weeks following these elections. And we found out that globally, of course, it's only one survey, but globally, the mental health was a little bit improved as compared to May, June 2020, which was not the case elsewhere around the globe. So this kind of observation tends to support what was mentioned previously with regards to national sense of coherence.
Yes, we also did interviews, deep interviews, so we can understood the data better. And in deeper understanding.
I think that Antonovsky already pointed at this kind of paradox. And I like to think of the perspectives that he brought on the chaos theory, the way he brought the chaos theory inside of the salutogenic approach. And I believe that we really need to rethink some of the issues that are behind the building up of the cities and of the world today. And for me, although I can understand the issue, I really can. But although for me, I see that the issue goes more on the side of how the human being is being brought up than on the real essence of the sense of coherence, because you refer to other countries, and you mentioned even my country, Portugal. As you know, Portugal has a long history of very peaceful relationships between different cultures. The Jews were the first to settle here in the Portuguese coastline to establish their communities. Then they came the Romans, the Visigoths, the Arabs, and all these communities tend to live peacefully. The Roman Pax was not necessary in this corner of the empire because the different communities, they were living quite in peace. But then they came the Christians. And then the Christians decided that the Jews were not to live in the same country. And then we had the Crusades. And it's the Portuguese who initiated the Portuguese Christian type of human being that initiated what is known today as the first world slave market, with consequences that are still today faced by all of us in different parts of the world. We were able to transform what was a peaceful environment in this corner of the of Earth into a very terrific experience for thousands and thousands of human beings. And all of this has to do with education, the education that was brought up. And I could say that during these times, the sense of coherence of these crusades that were born in the coastline of Portugal to conquer the Holy Land, the sense of coherence of these crusades should have been really on the top of what we could measure. But what was behind it was something very, very dark and very terrible in the name of religion, I would say. So anyway, I'm expressing myself according to what I and following the instinct of following your presentation, just waiting for some question to show up in the chat box. But it seems that our audience is very pleased to listen to you. So please just go on. And also, I'm very pleased to listen to you. Please, Matthew.
Thank you, Luis. Anyway, I think we will have to close the session because it's the closing session in 2 minutes. So maybe we can just encourage everyone to switch to the closing session ceremony. And just before, thank you very much to all my panelists. It was really a huge pleasure to share with the panel with you this afternoon. So thank you again. And maybe everyone can switch in the closing session ceremony.
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Matthew.
I agree with you, Luis, about education. It's all about education. I agree with you. We will talk about it.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.